later.
Obituaries are modest, aren't they? Yeah. Shirt always tucked in, skirt kept below the knee. Died unexpectedly. Could be anything from a heart attack while sitting on the Jakes to being stabbed by a burglar in the bedroom. Cops mostly know the truth, though. You don't always want to know, especially when it's one of your own, but you do. Because most of the time we're the guys who show up first with our reds lit and the walkie-talkies on our belts crackling out what sounds like so much gibble-gabble to the John Q's. For most folks who die unexpectedly, we're the first faces their staring open eyes can't see. When Tony Shane Dinks told us he was going to retire, I remember thinking, good, that's good. He's getting a little long in the tooth, not to mention a little slow on the uptake. Now, in the year 2006, I'm getting ready to pull the pin myself, and probably some of my younger guys are thinking the same thing. Long in the tooth, and slow in the draw. But mostly, you know, I feel the same as I ever did. Full of piss and vinegar, ready to work a double shift just about any day of the week. Most days when I note the gray hair which now predominates the black, or how much more forehead there is below the place where the hair starts, I think it's a mistake, a clerical error which will eventually be rectified when brought to the attention of the proper authorities. It is impossible, I think, that a man who still feels so profoundly 25 can look so half past 50. Then there'll be a stretch of bad days and I'll know it's no error. Just time marching on, that shuffling, rueful tread. But was there ever a moment as bad as seeing Ned behind the wheel of the Buick Roadmaster 8? Yes, there was one. Shirley was on duty when the call came in. A crack-up out on SR-32 near the Humboldt Road intersection, where the old Jenny Station used to be, in other words. Shirley's face was pale as ashes when she came and stood in the open door of my office. "What is it?" I asked. "What the hell's wrong with you?" "Sandy, the man who called it in said the vehicle was an old Chevrolet, red and white. He says the driver's dead," she swallowed. "In pieces, that's what he said." That part I didn't care about, although I would later, when I had to look at it. At him. "The Chevrolet, have you got the model?" I didn't ask Sandy. I couldn't. Her eyes were full of tears. I didn't dare. But how many old red and white Chevrolets do you think there are in Statler County? I went out to the scene with Phil Candleton, praying the crashed Chevy would turn out to be a Malibu or a Biscayne, anything but a Bel Air, vanity plate MY57. But that's what it was. "Fuck," Phil said in a low, dismayed voice. He'd piled it into the side of the cement bridge, which spans the Red Fern stream less than 5 minutes' walk from where the Buick 8 first appeared, and where Curtis was killed. The Bel Air had seat belts, but he hadn't been wearing one, nor were there any skid marks. "Christ almighty," Phil said. "This ain't right." Not right and not an accident. Although in the obituary, where shirts are kept neatly tucked in and skirts are kept discreetly below the knee, it would only say he died unexpectedly, which was true. Lord, yes. Looky-loos had started showing up by then, slowing to stare at what lay face down on the bridge's narrow walkway. I think one asshole actually took a picture. I wanted to run after him and stuff a shitty little disposable camera down his throat. "Get some detour signs up," I told Phil. "You and Carl send the traffic around by County Road. I'll cover him up." Jesus, what a mess. Jesus. Who's going to tell his mother? Phil wouldn't look at me. We both knew who was going to tell his mother. Later that day, I bit the bullet and did the worst job that comes with the big chair. Afterward, I went down to the country way with Shirley, Huddy, Phil, and George Stankowski. I don't know about them, but I myself didn't pass go or collect $200. Old Sandy went directly to shit-faced. I only have two clear memories of that night. The first is of trying to explain to Shirley how weird the country ways jukeboxes were. How all the songs were the very ones you never thought of anymore until you saw their names again here. She didn't get it. My other memory is of going into the bathroom to throw up. After, while I was splashing cold water on my face, I looked at myself in one of the wavery steel mirrors, and I knew for sure that the getting-to-be-old face I saw looking back at me was no mistake. The mistake was believing that the 25-year-old guy who seemed to live in my brain was real. I remembered Huddy shouting, "Sandy, grab my hand," and then the two of us, Ned and I, had spilled out onto the pavement, safe with the rest of them. Thinking of that, I began to cry. Died unexpectedly. That shit is all right for the county American, but cops know the truth. We clean up the messes, and we always know the truth. Everyone not on duty went to the funeral, of course. He'd been one of us. When it was over, George Stankowski gave his mother and his two sisters a ride home, and I drove back to the barracks with Shirley. I asked her if she was going to the reception, what you call a wake, I guess, if you're Irish, and she shook her head. I hate those things. So we had a final cigarette out on the smoker's bench, idly watching the young trooper who was looking in at the Buick. He stood in that same legs apart, goddamn the Democrats, did you hear the one about the traveling salesman pose that we all assumed when we looked into Shed B? The century had changed, but everything else was more or less the same. "It's so unfair," Shirley said. "A young man like that." "What are you talking about?" I asked her. "Eddie J. was in his late 40s, for God's sake, maybe even 50. I think his sisters are both in their 60s. His mother's almost 80. You know what I mean. He was too young to do that." "So was George Morgan," I said. "Was it?" She nodded toward Shed B. "I don't think so. Just his life. He made an honest effort to get sober, busted his ass. This was right after he bought Kurt's old Bel Air from Ned. Eddie always liked that car, you know, and Ned couldn't have it at Pitt anyway, not as a freshman. Would have just been sitting there in his driveway. And Ned needed the money. Going off to college from a single-parent home, every penny. So when Eddie asked him, he said, okay, sure. Eddie paid $3,500. "32," Shirley said with the assurance of one who really knows. 32, 35, whatever. "The point is, I think Eddie saw getting it as a new leaf he was supposed to turn over. He quit going to the tap. I think he started going to AA meetings instead. That was the good part. For Eddie, the good part lasted about 2 years." Across the parking lot, the trooper who had been looking into Shed B turned, spotted us, and began walking in our direction. I felt the skin on my arms prickle. In the gray uniform, the boy, only he wasn't a boy any longer, not really, looked strikingly like his dead father. Nothing strange about that, I suppose. It's simple genetics, a correspondence that runs in the blood. What made it eerie was the big hat. He had it in his hands and was turning it over and over. Eddie fell off the wagon right around the time that one there decided he wasn't cut out for college, I said. Ned Wilcox left Pitt and came home to Statler. For a year he'd done Archie's job, Archie by then having retired and moved back to Michigan, where everyone no doubt sounded just like him, a scary thought. When he turned 21, Ned made the application and took the tests. Now at 22, here he was. Hello, rookie. Halfway across the parking lot, Kurt's boy paused to look back at the shed, still twirling his Stetson in his hands. "He looks good, doesn't he?" Shirley murmured. I put on my old Sarge face, a little aloof, a little disdainful.
"Relatively squared away.
Shirley, do you have any idea how much bright red Dickens his ma raised when she finally found out what he had in mind?" Shirley laughed and put out her cigarette. She raised more when she found out he was planning to sell his dad's Bel Air to Eddie Jackaboy. At least that's what Ned told me. I mean, come on, Sandy. She had to know it was coming. Had to. She was married to one, for God's sake, and she probably knew this was where he belonged. Eddie, though, where did he belong? Why couldn't he just stop drinking once and for all?
That's the question for the ages, I said. They say it's a disease like cancer or diabetes. Maybe they're right.
Eddie had begun showing up for duty with liquor on his breath, and no one covered for him very long. The situation was too serious. When he refused counseling and a leave of absence to spend 4 weeks in the spin-dry facility the PSP favors for their stricken officers, he was given his choice, quit quietly or get fired noisily. Eddie had quit, with about half the retirement package he would have received if he'd managed to hang on to his job for another 3 years. At the end, the benefits really stack up. And I could understand the outcome no more than Shirley. Why hadn't he just quit? With that kind of incentive, why hadn't he just said, I'll be thirsty for 3 years and then I'll pull the pin and take a bath in it? I didn't know. The tap really did become Eddie J's home away from home, along with the old Bel Air, that was. He'd kept it waxed on the outside and spotlessly clean on the inside right up to the day when he'd driven it into the bridge abutment near Redfern Stream at approximately 80 miles an hour. He had plenty of reasons to do it by then. He was not a happy man. But I had to wonder if maybe there weren't a few reasons just a little closer to home. Specifically, I had to wonder if he hadn't heard that pulse near the end, that tidal whisper that's like a voice in the middle of your head. Do it, Eddie. Go on. Why not? There's not much else, is there? The rest is pretty well used up. Just step down a little brisker on the old go pedal and then twist the wheel to the right. Do it. Go on. Make a little mischief for your buddies to clean up. I thought about the night we'd sat out on this same bench. The young man I currently had my eye on, 4 years younger than he was now, and listening raptly as Eddie told the tale of stopping Brian Lippy's Bigfoot truck. The kid listening as Eddie told about trying to get Lippy's girl to do something about her situation before her boyfriend fucked her up beyond all recognition or maybe killed her. The joke turned out to be on Eddie, of course. So far as I knew, the bloody-faced girl is the only one of that roadside quartet still alive. Yeah, she's around. I don't road patrol much anymore, but her name and picture come across my desk from time to time. Each picture showing a woman closer to the beer-breath, broken-nose, fuck-you-for-a-pack-of-smokes hag she will, barring a miracle, become. She's had lots of DUIs, quite a few D&Ds, a trip to the hospital one night with a broken arm and hip after she fell downstairs. I imagine someone like Brian Lippy probably helped her down those stairs, don't you? Because they do pick the same kind over and over. She has two or... maybe it's three kids in foster care. So yeah, she's around. But is she living? If you say she is, then I have to tell you that maybe George Morgan and Eddie J had the right idea. I'm going to make like a bee and buzz, Shirley said, getting up. Can't take any more hilarity in one day. You doing okay with it?
Yeah, I said.
Hey, he came back that night, didn't he? There's that. She didn't have to be any more specific. I nodded, smiling. Eddie was a good guy, Shirley said. Maybe he couldn't leave the booze alone, but he had the kindest heart. Nope, I thought, watching her walk across to Ned, watching them talk a little. I think you're the one with the kindest heart, Cheryl. She gave Ned a little peck on the cheek, putting one hand on his shoulder and going up on her toes to do it. Then headed toward her car. Ned came over to where I was sitting. You okay? He asked. Yeah, good. And the funeral?
Hey, shit, it was a funeral. I've been to better and I've been to worse. I'm glad the coffin was closed.
Sandy, can I show you something? Over there? He nodded his head at Shed B.
Sure. I got up.
Is the temperature going down?
If so, it was news. It had been 2 years since the temp in there had dropped more than 5 degrees below the outside temperature. 16 months since the last light show, and that one had consisted of no more than 8 or 9 pallid flickers. No, he said. Trunk open? Shut tight as a drum? What then? I'd rather show you. I glanced at him sharply, for the first time getting out of my own head enough to register how excited he was. Then, with decidedly mixed feelings, curiosity and apprehension were the dominant chords, I guess, I walked across the parking lot with my old friend's son. He took up his sidewalk super's pose at one window and I took up mine at the next. At first I saw nothing unusual. The Buick sat on the concrete as it had for a quarter of a century, give or take. There were no flashing lights, no exotic exhibits. The thermometer's red needle stood at an unremarkable 73 degrees. So? I asked. Ned laughed, delighted. You're looking spang at it and don't see it. Perfect. I didn't see it myself at first. I knew something had changed, but couldn't tell what. What are you talking about? He shook his head, still smiling. No, sir, Sergeant. No, sir. I think not. You're the boss. You're also one of just 3 cops who were there then and are still here now. It's right in front of you. So go to it. I looked in again, first squinting and then raising my hands to the sides of my face to block the glare, that old gesture. It helped. But what was I seeing? Something, yes? He was right about that, but just what? What had changed? I remembered that night at the Country Way, flipping the pages of the dead jukebox back and forth, trying to isolate the most important question, which was the one Ned had decided not to ask. It had almost come, then had slipped shyly away again. When that happened, it was no good to chase. I'd thought that then and still did now. So instead of continuing to give the 8 my cop stare, I unfocused my eyes and let my mind drift away. What it drifted to were song titles, of course, titles of the ones they never seemed to play, even on the oldies stations, once their brief season of popularity is gone. Society's Child, and Pictures of Matchstick Men, and Quick Joey Small, and bingo, there it was. Like he'd said, it was right in front of me. For a moment, I couldn't breathe. There was a crack in the windshield. A thin, silver lightning bolt jig-jagging top to bottom on the driver's side. Ned clapped me on the shoulder. There you go, Sherlock. I knew you'd get there. After all, it's only right there in front of you. I turned to him, started to talk, then turned back to make sure I'd seen what I'd thought I'd seen. I had. The crack looked like a frozen stroke of quicksilver. When did it happen? I asked him. Do you know? I take a fresh Polaroid of it every 48 hours or so, he said. I'll check to make sure, but I'll bet you a dead cat and a string to swing it with that the last picture I took doesn't show a crack. So this happened between Wednesday evening and Friday afternoon at... He checked his watch, then gave me a big smile. At 4:15. Might even have happened during Eddie's funeral, I said. Possible, yeah. We looked in again for a little while, neither of us talking. Then Ned said, I read the poem you mentioned. The Wonderful One-Hoss Shay. Did you? Uh-huh. It's pretty good. Pretty funny. I stepped back from the window and looked at him. It'll happen fast now, like in the poem, he said. Next thing, a tire will blow, or a muffler will fall off, or a piece of the chrome. You know how you can stand beside a frozen lake in March or early April and listen to the ice creak? I nodded. This is going to be like that. His eyes were alight, and a curious idea came to me. I was seeing Ned Wilcox really, genuinely happy for the first time since his father died. You think? Yes. Only instead of ice creaking, the sound will be snapping bolts and cracking glass.
Cops will line up at these windows like they did in the old days. Only it'll be to watch things bend and break and come loose and fall off. Until finally the whole thing goes. They'll wonder if there isn't going to be one more flash of light at the very finish, like the final Chinese flower at the end of the fireworks display on the 4th of July.
Will there be, do you think?
I think the fireworks are over. I think we're going to hear one last big steel clank, and then you can take the pieces to the crusher.
Are you sure?
Nah, he said and smiled.
You can't be sure.
I learned that from you, and Shirley, and Phil, and Archie, and Huddy. He paused. And Eddie J. But I'll watch. And sooner or later.
He raised one hand, looked at it, then closed it into a fist, and turned back to his window.
Sooner or later.
I turned back to my own window, cupping my hands to the sides of my face to cut the glare.
I'd peered in at the thing that looked like a Buick Roadmaster 8. The kid was absolutely right. Sooner or later.
From a Buick 8 was written by Stephen King. James Rebhorn was the narrator, with Bruce Davison as Sandy, Becky Ann Baker as Shirley, Peter Garrity as Phil, Fred Sanders as Eddie, and Stephen Tobolowsky as Huddy and Archie. The recording engineers were Paul Fowley, Erica Weintraub, Michael Jones, and Matt Marin, with editing by Steven Strassman, and Common Mode, Paul Fowley, technical director. Post-production by Steven Strassman. The associate producers were Jessica Cassidy and Kelly Gilday. The Sandy sessions were directed by Fred Sanders. From a Buick 8 was produced and directed by Elisa Shokoff. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.